rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Yeah, every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Another fine day. Mittwoche. It's the middle of the week, and
Catherine DeBrecht is on the line with us. She has a new book. She's the author of several former books, the Help Mom series. It's actually, you're creating a franchise here, Catherine.
There's so much material out there. I could do a lot of Help Mom books.
Indeed. Yeah. On the cover, you have Al Gore and Hillary Clinton fighting over baby Jesus in the Nativity. The title of your new book, Help Mom, the Ninth Circuit Nabbed the Nativity, or How the Liberals Stole Christmas. Why use Christmas, an occasion, you know, the celebration of the birth of the Prince of Peace, the man who said, love your enemies. Why use Christmas in such a hateful way to trash liberals?
It's not a hateful way. It just shows that they're silly and misguided. But let me ask you this. Why use Christmas to wage a war on a religion that's going on in this country? I mean, you know, you have...
There is no war on religion.
You have so, Tom, you have so many instances where, you know, Santa Claus is deemed too religious for a breakfast of Santa for the kids. You can have the menorah and you can have the Star and Crescent in New York City public schools, but you can't have the Nativity. I mean, there's examples all over the country that this is going on.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Karen, Catherine, that there are some places in the United States where I think that they've gone too far. But there is, wouldn't you agree that there is a limit or that there is a reasonable point at which you say a school should, absolutely should, discuss and to a certain extent even celebrate religious holidays like Christmas and Hanukkah, and yet there is a line that you can step over where the school becomes essentially a church, a place of worship, and that's a line that we shouldn't cross?
Well, I think there's no problem whatsoever with teaching kids about the different religions and celebrating those, but you can't exclude one, which is what's happening now with Christianity, as opposed to the other religions.
I think it's a wonderful thing, you know, I
was in Christian schools all my life, and one of my favorite classes was world religions. It was fascinating to learn about other religions, and I think that schools should allow that.
But I don't disagree.
But look, Tom, look what the message is that's being sent in these schools when they say, okay, we can have this and this, but nothing Christian. It's sending a message to the kids that their religion is something profane and offensive.
Well, as I said, you may find a few misguided schools that I'm sure will be corrected on that, but by and large, that's not what's happening across the United States. This is a manufactured, you know, this whole Bill O'Reilly war on Christmas is a manufactured hysterical thing on the right. Why not point out the fact that right now there are 32 million Americans who don't know where their next meal is coming from. 12 million of them are going to go to bed hungry tonight. That would be what Jesus would be talking about. Why don't you talk about that rather than put Al Gore on the cover of your book, who's got nothing to do with Ninth Circuit Court?
Because, Tom, it is a way to show children that religion is not something that is disgusting and should be celebrated in the private door, behind closed doors in your private home. And it also teaches that how the far left in this country has driven the judicial system to basically bury the basic freedoms of speech and of religion in this country.
This has got nothing to do with the far left. And the judicial system is not burying religion. They're saying it's fine for you to discuss religion in schools. You simply can't mandate it.
Here's the problem, is what you have is you have like ACLU lawyers or one parent being offended, and these schools and these city councils and everyone is so afraid of a lawsuit because of somehow religion is offensive to them, but are so afraid of a lawsuit that they're going to bow down to a few people who are absolutely just looking to be offended.
Again, as I said, I'm not disagreeing with you that there are some schools, and these are the ones that you know, you and Matt Drudge and everybody on the right who wants there to be a war on Christmas will hold up and say, this is what's going on all over America.
Did you think 20 years ago that this would be happening?
No, I didn't. I really didn't think 20 years ago that the right would take this silly notion of a war on Christmas and turn it into a big national issue when people literally are going hungry in America. When there's 44 million people in America who have no health insurance, and you guys want to talk about a phony war on Christmas? This seems like you are spitting in the face of Jesus and the saints. I mean, it's just, this is trashing Christmas, what you're doing.
No, Christmas is being trashed because it's not allowed. Look at 20 years ago when you walked in the store, it was okay to say, have people say Merry Christmas. Now you've got to say Happy Holidays. I can barely find a Christmas card that says Merry Christmas. Look what's happening. Look at the stores that are. Kohl's is an example. Look at the Sunday ads from
Who cares?
Because it's Christmas.
It's Christmas, it's Hanukkah, it's a dozen different religions.
Sure,
what's wrong with saying Happy Holidays?
Fine, but why can't somebody say Merry Christmas?
I'm not saying
ask the stores why they won't let people, they're instructed
stores,
to say Happy Holidays.
Stores make business decisions.
Tom, you've got a school in Wisconsin that told their teachers that
stores are not
to
responding to government. They make business decisions.
You have schools like in Wisconsin where the teachers are instructed not to say Merry Christmas.
So you found a school where
you can look up
that has gone off the edge.
It's going all over in this country.
I don't believe it. I'm not seeing it. I'm
not.
I'm telling you.
You know why? Because
I'm telling you that you are missing the spirit of Christmas.
No, this is the reason why the left gets so upset about this, because it exposes them for what they are. Because the far left in this country doesn't like Christmas because it represents a religion that has a moral code, and that moral code gets in the way of all their liberal agenda in this country.
Speaking as a Christian myself, I find it offensive that anybody would use my religion as a way to trash individual politicians.
It's not. What you're doing,
I think what you're doing is offensive. I think what you're doing is anti-Christian.
It's anti-Christian.
I think Jesus would look at this and say,
Christ,
this is teaching hate.
How have you read the book?
I have. I actually read your book this morning.
And where is the hate in that?
Well, for example, here we have... you see, the senator said, pacing back and forth, Christmas may seem like a wonderful celebration to you, but not to us liberals. To us, it represents a religion with values and morals. Surely your teachers told you that values and morals interfere with the way we liberals like to run things. I'm sorry. That is a lie, Catherine. I am a liberal, I am a Christian, and I hold values and morals. And how can you say such a thing about me?
Well, because you're the far left in this country.
I am the far left in this country.
Wants their own moral code. Oh, abortion's okay. Gay marriage is okay. I define my moral code myself. There's nobody there.
I thought we were talking about Christmas.
I thought we were too, but then you brought this up, so I brought it.
So the idea that I am concerned that there are people starving in America, that there are people who don't have health care in America, that means that I have no moral code.
I don't get that. You can't equate that.
Or you don't give a damn about people who are alive. You're only concerned about fetuses.
We can go down that road if you want, Tom.
Well, that's essentially what you just said. You said that because I think that women should have a right to choose an abortion, I have no moral values. And I'm saying because you don't care about whether people are starving in America, you have no moral values. That's a silly argument.
Tom, it's moral relativism that you guys have. It's all, you know, if I want it this way, okay.
You are picking and choosing, Catherine DeBrecht, author of the Help Mommy, the Ninth Circuit, Nab the Nativity. You are picking and choosing the issues that you say are moral. And I'm suggesting to you that when people in America are going to bed hungry, that is a moral crisis. And you would rather put Al Gore and Hillary Clinton on the cover of your book to trash them for children who have nothing to do with the Ninth Circuit Court and have nothing to do with Christmas. This is a hateful thing you're doing.
No, it's not. It's an example to teach kids that they don't need to be ashamed of their religion and to explain to them why their religion is under attack in this country.
This has nothing to do with not being ashamed with religion.
Here it is. You can't have anything. Oh, no.
Also, again, quoting from your book.
We don't want Christmas. We don't want crosses here. You know, you can police officers in this country can't have a cross on their uniforms, or else they wind up getting sued. But you can throw a cross in a bucket of urine, and that's considered art. That is what
I don't think that's art. I, you know, and that is not what your book is talking about. There's no reference to that in your book. But in your book, you do say, as the boys walk next door to Congresswoman Clunkton's office, that would be Congresswoman Clinton, obviously, her picture, Johnny stopped and asked Luke, isn't she the lady who was trying to sell lima bean cookies at our bake sale? I mean, number one.
Oh, is that hateful?
I would
humor. If you just humor.
All Luke could remember was that the cookies tasted worse than Aunt Heather's fruitcake. Clunton was signing pictures of herself while her assistant gave her a foot rub. She didn't seem interested in the boys' problems until they mentioned the TV cameras and other politicians who had been at their school. Then she grabbed her purse and immediately began applying makeup. When they said they were looking for the Constitution, her face crinkled and grew very red. Where on earth did you kids learn about that? Clunton raised her voice and slammed down her powder puff. Hillary Clinton doesn't give a damn about the Constitution. This is hateful speech you're promulgating, Catherine DeBrecht.
It is not hateful speech. Look, the woman's running for president. She needs to have her views exposed so people really know what she is.
And you think she
for.
Doesn't care about the Constitution?
She cares for the Constitution like the liberals do when they twist it around and it helps them and benefits them.
I find this tragic. But I encourage our listeners to check it out and make up their own mind. Help Mom, the Ninth Circuit, nab the Nativity, Catherine DeBrecht's new book, or How the Liberals Stole Christmas. Catherine, thanks for coming on with us. It's always interesting talking with you.
You too, Tom.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, too.
Thank you.
Can't believe you said that.
I'll.
And
you're by now. And I did say it. 16 minutes past the hour. Our number, 866-440-8466. Yes, the war on Christmas underway. Us liberals leading the charge, right? We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Mary be played by an Asian who's gay. We think that this Joseph should be Josephine. Why couldn't the three kings be three Swiss drag queens? And for baby Jesus, we think you should try a differently abled small person who's by. We've one more request, though you might think it strange. The cattle and sheep simply must be free range. We're not anti-virgin, but this suit you'll lose, we'll file to defend Mary's right to choose. And one day your children will have the Lord's care, 'cause once you're in heaven, no lawyers live there.
Yes, it's Catherine DeBrecht's dream of how bad it can get. Welcome back, 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. As one of the folks in the chat room, let's see here, who was it who said it? Workplace democracy? No. Ivy's mom. Yes, Ivy's mom. She says, since the criminal war they started isn't going so hot, they have to turn our attention to the war on Christmas. Yes, it's that season again. Time for the war on Christmas. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. And Mark in Concord, New Hampshire. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
How are you today, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. Mark, how about you?
Well, that's what I was looking for. I just wanted to comment on your last interview there, and she claims to be sticking up for those who want to be proud of their religion. And you know, one of the quiet undercurrents that's going on right now, you read a little bit about, is people of the Wiccan or pagan faith are being denied the right to put their religious symbol on tombstones for those who have died in Iraq.
Right. There have been three or four, haven't there not, Wiccan soldiers who have died in Iraq, and they wanted to have, is it a pentagram on the tombstone?
Yeah. I don't think they call it the pentagram, but it's
five-pointed star.
One of those symbols and religions that since probably about 500 A.D. has been under attack. Mm. In fact, I think that the winter solstice celebration that we now call Christmas was not Christmas. I don't think Jesus Christ was even born on the 25th of December.
I think the historical record kind of indicates that it was in March that he was born, in all probability. But
right.
But that appropriation of the winter solstice worked quite well for the early church.
Sure, it made some people happy, and
but in any case, your point, Mark, is that there's a war on paganism. If there is a war on Christianity, the war on paganism is actually even more effective.
Exactly.
Okay, all righty. Thanks a lot. I appreciate the call. Chris in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Tom. This is one issue that Americans as a whole just kind of avoid other issues like health care and poverty, just, you know.
Well, that's why I kept bringing those things up with Catherine. I think that, you know, this is the giant distraction that the vast media machine is going to try and crank at us. And I think it's important to point out that it's a giant distraction and that there are real issues beyond this so-called war on Christmas.
Now, I called the people up on the right, and I asked them a vague question. What do you think the issues are in America? And they said that's a vague issue or vague question, and they just hung up on me. I mean, yeah. I kind of switched back and forth, and I never hear anything about what is going on in America that could be helped to, you know, fix the society, you know?
Yeah, and these are really the issues that we need to be focusing on. Well said, Chris, and good on you for calling the other talk shows as well. Jack, and thank you for calling us. Jack in Milford, Connecticut. Hey, Jack.
Hey, good morning. Or good afternoon, rather.
All of the above.
Catherine was wrong on so many levels. It just made my blood boil. Just I'm Jewish. I married a Catholic woman. I raised my daughter Catholic, and I sent her to Catholic school. So I see these issues on a personal level. I could tell you I personally experienced prejudice being Jewish, but I've never seen anybody in my family be discriminated because they're Christian.
Yeah.
So I think this war that she has on Christmas is in her head.
Yeah, and how can the majority be discriminated against?
And it's in the heads of people on the edges. Of, you know, in the 60s, we could say this country was hijacked by liberals on the edge of liberalism.
Well, see, this is the exact same strategy that the KKK used, for example, back in the late 1800s and early 1900s to build their membership, was to tell, you know, white people that they were disenfranchised, that they were being discriminated against, they were being attacked. Well, actually, I mean, to this day, that the KKK uses in the white power movement. It's telling the majority that they are a minority and behaving as if they are.
Absolutely. And believe me, if somebody wrote a book saying that how we should coexist with people that are different than us, they wouldn't sell a copy.
Yeah. Well, actually, so, you know, some would argue that that book has been written. It's called the Bible.
Well, okay, I agree with that. Yeah, absolutely right.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. And you know, let's point out, too, that this whole, you know, there's an other and they're trying to harm us, that was Hitler's shtick, too. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I wish a one horse open sleigh would come carry me away, but I've been waiting here all day, and one just hasn't come my way. Now, excuse me if I'm not being reverent, but I was hoping for a miracle to hold me, wash me, save me from my righteous doubt as I watch helpless, and everybody sings, if it's Hanukkah. Or Kwanzaa, solstice, harvest, or December 25th, peace on earth to everyone, and abundance to everyone.
And welcome back. You're right here in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy, sometimes referred to as the vast liberal conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friend. Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. It's interesting, looking at the lineup of callers here, about half of them are disagreeing with my position and taking Catherine's, and about half of them the other way around. So let's just kind of mix this up and go through this. Kevin in Tupelo, Mississippi. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you. I agree with Catherine. It's not because I subscribe to any particular religion. It's because the way it's done. Once you take something away, it's hard to give it back. Okay? I salute Lowe's Corporation for actually putting up the signs, Merry Christmas this year.
Sure. Well, now, I think we have to separate two issues here. Catherine's book, first of all, does not talk about any commercial business. Commercial businesses are in business. They can make decisions about whether they want to say Merry Christmas, Happy Kwanzaa, or Blessed Be. That's up to them, and they're going to do whatever makes them the most profit. And I understand
that,
and that makes sense. But a public school system, as I was saying, I think it's perfectly appropriate for schools to acknowledge religion, to teach about even about religions, to say things like Merry Christmas, even to have some religious symbols around. I have no problem with any of that. Where I have a problem is when a school becomes a house of worship. That is when, for example, a nativity play where the birth of Jesus is played out in a school. That is actually teaching one of the myths of
religion. I have no problem with that whatsoever, as long as they give equal time and equal space to another religion.
But see, that's not going to happen. And where does it end? I mean, you're going to have the pagans saying, well, hey, what about our Yule log? And you're going to have, the Hindus saying, hey, what about, Krishna was born around this time. And then it just never ends. There is a clear division between church and state in the United States. And because our public school systems are owned by the state.
Church and state, okay, that specifies that the government cannot specify a religion.
That's right. And if a religion is being promoted in the school, I would submit to you that it violates the First Amendment.
But the schools that I have heard about, and there's been several that I've heard, because I travel all over the country, I'm a truck driver, the schools I have heard about, right, they are not, the school is not presenting the nativity scene. It's individuals coming into the school, renting space or whatever they do or however they decide, and two of them have donated
and trying to turn schools into institutions of proselytization for their religion. And I'm sorry, Kevin, I'm just opposed to that. Kevin, I got to move along, but thank you for your call and for your thoughts. I appreciate it. Steve driving in Utah. Hey, Steve.
Yeah, hi, Tom. It's good to talk to you. As I tell my friends, you are the professor. But on this issue, Dude, I don't think there's a war. I do think there's an attack, and I'll just make it quick. When I was a child, we sang Silent Night, Holy Night, all that good stuff in schools. And
same here.
And now, even my kids are going to the same school I went to, and they don't even call it the Christmas play anymore. It's called the winter performance. They don't sing Silent Night, Holy Night.
Better? I mean, I remember, one of my best friends, his name was Tom Stedman. He lived in the house right behind us when I was growing up in Lansing, Michigan. And he was Jewish, and I had very little concept of what that even meant, until Christmas time one year when he was like, telling me how on the outside looking in he felt. And it hadn't even occurred to me. But, I mean, what's wrong with saying, hey, it's winter time. There's a bunch of different religions that are having holidays right now. The Christians are having Christmas. The Jews are having Hanukkah. The Wiccans are having Yule log. I mean, what's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, I see what you're saying. It's just, I just think people are getting too offended by the word Christmas, and they're getting a little out of hand.
Well, I'm not offended by it at all, and see, that's the problem. I think that there is a straw man being created by the right wing here who is suggesting that people on the left are offended by it, and nobody on the left is offended by Christmas. A lot of us embrace Christmas. A lot of us are proudly Christians. What people who are constitutionalists are saying is that if we are paying for our schools with our tax dollars or any other public institutions with our tax dollars, they can be used to acknowledge religion, but they should not be used to promote any particular religion. It's just that simple, and that's what it boils down to.
Yeah, well, like usual, you make a very good point. Well, thank
thanks a lot, Steve. Good to hear from you. Evelyn, in Roseburg, Oregon, the hometown of our producer, David Poole. Hey, Evelyn.
Hi. I just want to call and commend you. I think that your program and you standing up to that lady that called that wrote that book,
mm-hmm.
I'm tired of saying that the right wing are not Christian, or they are...
You mean the left wing is not Christian?
I mean the left wing are not Christian, and the right wing is making fun of it. I am a Christian, but I am a Democrat, and that's the way I'm going to stay.
There you go. Well said, Evelyn. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. And this is the kind of stuff that flows out of this, by the way. Here you've got this right-wing crank, Dennis Prager, who, by the way, is Jewish. He's on a Christian network, the Salem Network, which started out as a Christian broadcasting network. And Dennis Prager has a history of taking right-wing Christian positions. And here he is. He says, And he's talking about the whole, you know, whether or not Keith Ellison, the Democrat from Minnesota, who converted from Catholicism to Islam and was elected to Congress, and he wants to put his hand on a Quran when he gets sworn in for the photo op. This is not even the legal swearing in. The legal swearing in doesn't use a Bible. And he says, Prager says, if Ellison swears in on a Quran, it would undermine American civilization and be akin to swearing in with a copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf. And yesterday, the Council on Islamic Relations called on Prager to be removed from his five-year taxpayer-funded appointment by George Bush to the United States Holocaust Memorial Council. Here, this guy is on the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council, which is supposed to remind us of the danger of religious-based divisiveness and hate. And so this can get really big and really dangerous. Steve in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Steve.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Yeah, hey, just outside the Orlando area in Osceola County, mm-hmm. I've seen signs for where there's church held in public schools on the weekend.
Oh, yeah, that's, I have no problem with that. That happens here, too. That's basically just renting space. You've got an empty building, you want to rent some space from it. That's a very different thing from saying to school children who are required by law to be in school that they have to listen to, you know, a particular religious story and hear it as if it was fact.
Right. Right. Yeah, I'd never looked into it to see if they were just basically making some money.
They are, I can tell you, because I used to attend a church back many years ago that was in a public school, and we just, you know, we rented the auditorium from the school. Nah, it's not a big deal. That's you don't have to worry about that. So, Karen in Sacramento, California. Hey, Karen, thanks for listening on KSAC there, KSAC and Talk City.
Hi, I am a Christian, and I am a very far left Democrat.
Well, welcome to the club.
And I couldn't believe she was taking those pot shots at Hillary Clinton. It seems like profit is okay when we want to steal somebody's pension, but then profit is not okay when we want to have freedom of religious. But my allusion to Hillary was, I remember the morning habeas corpus was taken away. Hillary was up there fighting on Capitol Hill, reciting the story of Washington, instructing his troops to treat the detainees well.
Yes.
To show them, you know, how loving we are, and that, like, we're the moral high ground, if there is one.
Yes, and she gave a very eloquent speech, although she would not vote for a filibuster, which concerned me. But then there was the political reality that the Democrats didn't have the 60 votes they needed, so it would have been an empty gesture, I guess. But I think it would have been a good gesture. But in any case, yes, she did, and she voted against the Military Commissions Act, and good on her for doing that. And it was a very eloquent speech. In fact, I played part of it on this radio program.
Yeah. I think that's where I heard it.
Yeah, okay, great. Karen,
thanks for
the heads up and the reminder. Now, on the other side, here's Stuart in Seattle listening on Talk 1090. He says Hillary doesn't defend the Constitution. Do I have that right, Stuart?
That's right. I agreed with your first guest. No, Hillary does not support the Constitution. She supports her own personal power. Did she not vote for the USA Patriots' role in their Graves Act? I believe she did. Correct me if I'm wrong on that one.
No, I believe Hillary did vote for the Patriot Act.
Yes, the Patriot, the so-called Patriot Act. We cannot say Patriot Act without saying so-called. That was throwing away the whole Constitution, the habeas corpus, the right to search and seizure.
Stuart, I can give you a long list of votes that Hillary has made with
and
which I strongly disagree.
Unconstitutional thing that she did. Are we still on the air?
Sure.
The other unconstitutional thing she did was to give the president the right to go to war when he wanted. That was the constitutional right that the Congress should be the one to declare war. They said, no, we're not declaring war, but we're giving the president the right to go kill whoever.
I agree with you, and I think it's tragic that Hillary Clinton, unlike some folks like John Edwards, who voted also to give him that power, and has now said, you know, that was a terrible mistake, I never should have done that. John Edwards did the right thing. Hillary has not yet done that. And I hope that she would. I really hope that she would, and continue to hope that she would. But so far, she hasn't.
Yeah, I believe the only reason that she's considered a front runner is she's friends with the big media people.
Well, it may well be. I don't know. We'll have to see how it shakes out. But Stuart, thank you for listening and thank you for calling. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your phone calls, 866-440-8466. Drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com. Also a message board over there. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Oh, but ain't that America for you and me? Ain't that America something to see, baby? Ain't that America?
Indeed it is. It's America. Welcome back to Tom Hartman Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Deacon in Mesquite, Texas. Hey, Deacon, welcome to the program.
Thomas, how are you, you sick, twisted, left-wing liberal freak?
I own up to it. What's up, Deacon?
You do own up to it. Well, I just want to take issue with a couple of points, and that's where you said that you didn't understand how the majority could be set at bay or put upon by the minority. Well, Thomas,
well, no, that happens all the time. What I'm saying is that the majority can't be successfully destroyed by the minority, generally speaking. And, you know, Christianity is the majority religion in the United States. I think some 90% of Americans are Christian or in some way or another. You know, a lot of them are unchurched. But you know, how you're going to declare war against them with any kind of success, it's a joke.
Well, how about this guy who said he couldn't, you know, figure out how there was nothing going on to help the underprivileged and that what we need to do is concentrate? There's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of charities and government sponsorment programs as we speak that are out there to help the less fortunate and the
right.
people that are poor in this country. They're
right.
there right now as you and I speak on this radio show.
Well, I know. I'm on the board of directors of one of them. What about it?
The gentleman that called sounded like he was already dead. He must have been as long. He didn't know that, you know, what are we doing now? We're doing nothing to help these people that really need help. We need to concentrate on having more programs and on and on. Everything is in place that we need. All the charities that we need. Billions, not billions, billions of dollars a year to help.
If that's the case, Deacon, then why do we have 30 million people in the United States who don't know where the next meal is going to come from?
Because it may mean what we're doing is not enough, Tom, but the point is we are doing that. You can't sit there and say that we're not when the
All right. No, I got it. And I don't disagree with you. Good point. And similarly, like we have Medicare. And Medicare is a great program, but it should be extended to every single person in the United States. Nicole in Grand Junction, Colorado. Hey, Nicole.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Fine. What's up?
I just wanted to talk about religion within the school system.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up, a lot of times, my family was of a religion that didn't celebrate Christmas and didn't celebrate Halloween and those kind of holidays.
Sure.
So to go to the school and not be a part of that, what happened with me was they just put me out in the hall for 2 hours.
You're kidding.
No.
That's no fun. So,
no.
So you're suggesting that basically schools shouldn't even, what, acknowledge religion? Or religious holidays, rather?
I think that it's the family's job to acknowledge that.
Yeah. I'm suggesting that the schools can't avoid acknowledging it any more than the schools could avoid talking about 9/11 when it happened. I mean, this is something that everybody's talking about. Everywhere you look, you see evidence of it. You see, you know, but there's a big difference between acknowledging something and promoting something.
Right.
Or proselytizing for something.
Right.
And you know, back when I was in school, it was, I mean, I was part of the Christmas play, you know, when I was in
mm-hmm.
third grade or something like that. You know, I played one of those, whatever it was, I forget what the role was, you know, or the wise men or something like that. And it was a way of teaching the story of Jesus. Well, that's something that should be done in churches. That should
schools. You also have to acknowledge people that aren't a part of that.
Yes,
you know?
I absolutely agree. And you know, there are many Christian religions as well, the Anabaptists, the fundamentalist Methodists, who do not celebrate these holidays.
We were Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, Jehovah's Witnesses, another great example, who believe
mm-hmm.
that it's blasphemous to celebrate these holidays and in fact, you know, violates biblical code. And, you know, they should be acknowledged as well. Nicole,
yep.
Good point. Thank you very much for making it. I appreciate
Thanks.
It. Thanks for the call. Spike in Easton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Spike.
Hey, Gonzo, greetings. Long time no speak. You know, that woman that you had earlier in the show, I mean,
Catherine DeBrecht.
Yeah, she was.
CatherineDeBrecht.net is her website, by the way.
Yeah, she was really a blatant anti-Semite, even if she didn't come out and say anti-Semitic words. You know, she made the comment at one point how, oh, well, schools are taking down the Santa Clauses, but they're leaving up the menorahs. Two points, excuse me. One is, are all Jews going to go to hell in her mind because they're not believing in her version of Christianity, as whacked out as it may be? And the other is, Santa Claus was created by the Coca-Cola Corporation to sell things. See, what
the modern Santa Claus, yeah. The old St. Nicholas was a skinny guy. And but, you know, I would say that Santa Claus, actually, my old friend Steve Larson, who was Joseph Campbell's protege and wrote the only official authorized biography of Joseph Campbell, Fire in the Mind, Stephen told me the story about how and Spike, thank you for the call, how in Norway, and Stephen is Norwegian, and my father's mother and father came from Norway, so we tell stories about that. In Norway, the shaman used to go looking for yellow snow because there's a type of mushroom in Norway that grows. It's a white mushroom with red dots on it, and it contains a hallucinogen. It contains dimethyltryptamine, but it's also so toxic it will kill you. But reindeer eat this mushroom, and their livers detoxify it, and then they pee out the dimethyltryptamine, the DMT, the active ingredient, the hallucinogen. And so the shaman would go around looking for reindeer pee in the snow. They'd gather this stuff up, and they would make a soup out of it, a brew out of it, and they'd drink it, and they would go on these wild trips, these, you know, psychedelic trips as part of their religious rituals, these Norwegian shaman, you know, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. And you read the writings of Terence McKenna, and he talks about how taking DMT, the world rips apart, and you see little people, these little elves. And Santa just happens to be the color of the mushroom. And the reindeer are flying, just like the, you know, it's the flying reindeer, right? The reindeer who are given the hallucinogen. So really, Santa Claus is an old earth religion-based character, a character from the old Norwegian stories of that the shaman had of that time of year when they would fly with the reindeer into the other worlds to help the tribe and help the community out. It's interesting stuff, but and probably a complete tangent from all the rest of this, but I found it fascinating. Anyway, 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Jeffrey Feldman with Frame Shop is open. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour, and then we'll be back with your phone calls and more news of the day.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. The Tom Hartman radio program, speaking of think tanks, a left-wing think tank run by Jeffrey Feldman. FrameShopIsOpen.com. Jeffrey, the editor-in-chief and one of the leading experts on framing in the United States, a regular guest on the program. Jeffrey, welcome.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
Great to have you with us. I want to get to the frame about the war on Christmas in just a minute. I want to wrap up with that because we've been talking about that in the last hour, and I got a bunch of callers who want to continue talking about it. But the Iraq Study Group also just came out with their recommendations, and they're starting to filter now through the media into our hands. And you have several different takes, actually, on the Iraq Study Group. One on the larger meme of the Iraq Study Group itself, you know, just the whole thing, and it appearing on Amazon.com and whatnot, and then others on the specific details. Go with that.
Yeah, I mean, the big issue, I think, is first how the president is reacting to the entire report. And what's really interesting is to notice how the president is latching onto the word forward in his press announcement. He did a kind of a PR spot with the group this morning. And what's been really interesting is to see how the president's defining moving forward in terms of not having partisan bickering inside Washington, D.C. This seems to build on the idea that's been growing in the president's rhetoric for the past year, where he's defined failure in Iraq as U.S. troops actually leaving Iraq. So anything that constitutes U.S. troops leaving has been defined as pulling out, cutting and running, words like timetables. All that has been the definition of failure for the president. So that's a huge problem, because what the Iraq Study Group is going to recommend is that U.S. troops pull out of Iraq. So what the president is trying to do in these first few hours is define the significance of this report as really being an opportunity for people in Washington to work together, as if failure has been a product of people bickering in Washington. And this is the familiar arguments about civility and bipartisanship that have been coming out of the White House, no surprise, since the Democrats won huge in the midterm elections.
Right. And really what this is a very elegant frame for, please don't point out our past sins. Please don't discuss the lies that the Bush administration has done in the past. Please don't discuss how we got into this war in the first place. Let's put all of that behind us and only look forward.
Exactly. Only look up the road, up the path, which is a way that the president has been trying to frame the disaster in Iraq for a long time now, constantly attempting to distract the public into looking forward rather than focusing on what's in front of them.
Well, he doesn't want people to remember that he lied us into this war.
Exactly. And what's really interesting is if you listen to the news coverage almost immediately after that press event with the president, you can see that there's a struggle going on in the media. Part of the media wants to pick up on the president's frame, but another part of it wants to forward this alternative frame, which is the idea of listening to the Iraq study group. NBC in particular, the larger group, they had on the cover of Newsweek this week, the cover story was in big bold letters, "Will the President Listen?" And that idea, will the president actually listen, is a very powerful response. I heard just this morning Andrea Mitchell was talking about the big problem coming out of the Iraq report is whether or not the Democrats will work with the Republicans on this. On the other hand,
so she's Andrea Mitchell, whose husband is Alan Greenspan,
yeah,
a notorious right-wing Republican extremist. She and she herself, no small partisan, I would submit. Andrea Mitchell is framing this as the Democrats are the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
That the president lied us into a war.
Right.
Democrats
are
the problem.
She went right for the facts from the White House, and she just picked it up and read it off. But then you have Tim Russert on the other, you know, in a very similar moment in the broadcast saying, look, the issue here is the president has to listen. We've got real strong language in this report, and the president needs to hear it. The rose-colored glasses need to come off and so forth. So there's going to be a little bit of a struggle in the next 24 hours in the media to see which frame wins out. And we'll see where it's going to head.
Yeah. And of course, then there's the larger issue of what U.S. policy is going to be. And to some extent, it appears that that is going to be a function of what Mr. Gates decides or can convince the president of.
Yeah, it does seem that Gates, who's going to get that nomination for to be the Secretary of Defense, is really the key piece in this whole process. Because what we have is the Iraq Study Group essentially saying that things are an absolute disaster, using that, you know, this phrase, grave and deteriorating, basically saying that, you know, all concepts that we had before are now need to be swept away, and we need to look at the situation in a new, very broad regional perspective. Mm. No more neocon fantasies. We need to start thinking of ways to negotiate with the players in the region in order to get them to the table. So, for example, people may be surprised to find out that one of the proposals in the Iraq Study Group is to actually give back the Golan Heights to the Syrians in order to bring them to the table to talk about what's going on in the Middle East. A radical proposal, a really, really remarkable, which completely does away with these notions of spreading freedom and building democracy and growing neocon-type economies. And it's going to force the president to accept that his vision, his fantasy, as it were, has completely collapsed. And I think that Graves is the person who can sell that to him, if anybody can.
Yeah, and speaking on behalf of his father, in fact, without it being his father, it seems. In that context, and people can really get this by going to your website, frameshopisopen.com, and actually looking at the photos. You made an interesting observation, listening to George Bush say something and then watching him say something and noting the difference.
Yeah, I mean, the larger point is that when we talk about framing, you know, obviously we're talking about the words that people are using, but there's another side of framing which has to do with the way people stage their words, what people do with their bodies, with their face, with the tone of their voice. And in his press conference in Amman, Jordan, just a few days ago, what I noticed was that I had a real different reaction to the president's words when I actually watched the video instead of reading the transcript. Typically, I read the transcripts because I focus in on the phrasing. But when you looked at President Bush, the way he slumped with his head and his shoulders and the way he turned his eyes and the way he spoke incredibly loudly, I mean, even the media commented on that. It seemed to say that he was very afraid, that this was a moment where Bush was reacting to the changing circumstances, the coming of the Iraq Study Group report, with a real, almost an angry fear. I'd encourage people to look very closely at how the president is reacting physically and not just what he's saying. I had one reader at Frameshop tell me that a great exercise is to turn down the volume on the TV when you're watching Bush to get a sense for what his emotions are.
And just do that the first time and then turn it back up the second time and listen to the words.
Exactly.
There is some considerable debate, actually, in the psychiatric community about what medications George W. Bush may be on. And in particular, when he travels, his father used to take Halcyon to sleep, which is a powerful benzodiazepine drug, led him to throw up in the lap of the Japanese prime minister once. The speculation about whether George W. is taking drugs on a regular basis or whether he just does it when he travels in order to sleep like his father did, or at least his father, admitted to doing. Do you think it's possible that what you could have been seen in that video in Amman, Jordan, and his fear might have just been some sort of anxiety that was the consequence of one of the main side effects of some of these very rapid acting sleep drugs is that the day after people feel more anxious because they're essentially going through Valium withdrawal, benzodiazepine withdrawal.
Yeah, that's definitely possible. I mean, the president is also not known to be a big traveler, so the way that they're shuttling him around the planet in order to have the appearance that he's actually being a diplomat and a statesman could also be building on that and the effects of whatever it is that they have on.
I'm curious, Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief over at frameshopisopen.com, I'm curious what your take is on this whole war on Christmas frame. Bill O'Reilly, of course, beating the drum, but not just him. I mean, there's this new book out, Catherine DeBrecht. I had her on as a guest in the first hour. It's being promoted very aggressively. You have Dennis Prager, who, while he's not promoting the war on Christmas frame, he's promoting the Christians under attack frame with his attack against the new Muslim member of Congress who
Keith
wants to
Ellison.
Put his hand. Yeah, Keith Ellison, who wants to put his hand on a Koran to be sworn in. What are your thoughts on all this?
Well, the broader issue that comes out of someone like Dennis Prager is that somehow we are a biblical nation where all values seem to emanate in this country, seem to have their origins, according to Prager, in the Bible rather than the Constitution. And that if you're a good American, then you should work very hard to make sure that only the Bible is included in our civil rituals, which, of course, is completely false. I mean, the whole notion of the separation of church and state is built on a diversity of religious expression, not just having one religion dominate in our government.
Well, not only that, both Jefferson and John Adams, the first conservative president and the first liberal president, the first liberal being Jefferson, the first conservative being John Adams, both agreed that the idea that the U.S. Constitution and for that matter, British law is grounded in the Bible was a, quote, fraud of the clergy, end quote. Jefferson pointed out the British law goes back to the year 500, and Britain didn't become a Christian nation until the year 700, more or less, the Heptarchy. And so, it's just not the case.
Yeah, war on Christmas is a massive distraction by the right wing, and people should take this moment to remember our soldiers at this time, not to turn Christmas into some perversion where we take the time to attack Democrats. This is really a moment to remember those people who are missing from our families.
That's a good frame. Thank you. Jeffrey Feldman, Frame Shop is open, the website, frameshopisopen.com. Good talking with you, Jeffrey.
Thanks, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Here's the news, coming to you every hour upon the hour. The weather's fine, but there may be a meteor shower.
And welcome back. Exposing the con in conservative. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Will in South Park, Colorado. Hey, Will, welcome to the program.
Hey, Truth Teller. How you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Oh, well, I wanted to get on I was going to say the religious thing, that's kind of maybe run away from Christianity is the lies and the majority of the, when they get into big groups. I know quite
a few
Christian people, but then they get in a big group and say, yeah, we got to go to war.
Well, come on, Will. I enjoy going to church. I enjoy participating with other people in religious worship, even though I get it. You know, in the Sermon on the Mount, what Jesus was talking about was make your religion actually spirituality rather than religiosity. I mean, you know, he said, when you pray, go into the closet and close the door and do it in private. I get it that, you know, praying out in public is hypocritical. And yet, still, you know, it feels kind of cool to me. It feels good.
I dug it as a child, man. I was totally into the Jesus trip until the adults started telling me all these little sidekicks about it. Unless you're this person.
Well, see, I think a lot of us are wise enough to just say, yeah, there's some nutcases among us. We're not gonna buy into that. Idea of the Crusades, for example, you know?
Yeah, I hear you. But what I was thrilled about hearing was when you started talking about the commission having a report out. Did you hear the report? The idea of that report is kind of like a cover-up for W, or is it just me? And I'll hear you later.
Well, what do you mean? Will, what do you mean by that?
Well, I admit they're coming out saying how, well, we've got to be we've come together as a team. Republicans and Democrats have decided, you know, us who know, and we've decided that W didn't do anything wrong. I mean, they're not even getting on the subject matter.
Oh, yeah.
It's an unnecessary war that kind of killed a lot of people that didn't have to, and lots of them being Iraqis, and we're not successful in any way.
I think
stealing our rights, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think you're right, Will. What I'm hearing and what I'm reading, and of course it's all dribbling out right now, and I'm, you know, furiously reading this stuff during the breaks, is that the Iraq Study Group is not at all addressing the question of whether or not we got lied into a war, whether or not it was a crime, what Bush did getting us into the war, any of that kind of thing. It's all, you know, and perhaps...
New terminology. They're just going for new terminology on how W isn't really wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Good
point. Have a great day, man.
Thanks, you too. And maybe it's appropriate that they, you know, maybe they were only commissioned to deal with let's go forward on this, just like the group that was looking into Iran-Contra was only commissioned to look into what happened after 1982, not what happened before 1982, because what happened before 1982, when it was set up, the deal to sell the missiles and spare parts to Iran, it had to do with a deal for hostages and, you know, swapping military parts for hostages. And they didn't really want to look into that. But I don't think they're going to avoid having Congress look into this. I just don't think they're going to be able to avoid it. James in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, James, what's up?
Hey, I was calling to talk to you about Forget the War on Christmas. In my opinion, the right wing is conducting a war on Christianity by turning young people off to the Bible, like my two sons.
How so?
Their best friends are like fundamentalist Christians, and they're really turned off by the hatred that they talk about, like gays and other people.
Yeah, who would have thought that a religion founded by a man who was preaching tolerance and love even for your enemies, would turn into a group, or would have spring out of it, individual small sects that are promoting hatred? I mean, who would have thought?
I don't get it, and I try to get my kids to read the Bible, and they just don't want to do it because they're like, oh, Jesus is that guy that hates people and tells people they're bad and condemns them. And it's not just my sons. I talk with their friends, and a lot of the young people today, they don't want to read the Bible because those people that wrap themselves in the Bible, they just talk about hating this group and that group, and there's a war on Santa.
Well, tragic, yeah, I agree. And tragically, they're not representing Christianity, at least the Christianity that I grew up with and know and believe in. So, James, thanks for the call and the point. Elaine, in Helsinki, Finland?
That's right. And we're having our Independence Day here, Tom.
Well, congratulations. Happy Independence. You're an American expat living in Finland?
Yes, I'm an American expat living in Finland, and even though I'd like to talk about some other stuff, I saw the Iraq Study Group press conference on BBC World. They showed the vast majority of it, and this message of, you know, well, because we're five Democrats and we're five Republicans, that America has to fall over itself and go along and get along, I think is wrong. I mean, I think the message is get out of there as fast as we can. I mean, I wish that James Baker could say that, you know, George Bush made a mistake. He lied. He led us into a war.
But James Baker is the guy who put George Bush in the presidency in the first place in 2000. He went down to Florida and orchestrated the whole thing with the Supreme Court.
Yes, I know. It's terrible. And Lee Hamilton doesn't have all that much credibility with me. I mean, he was on the 9/11 Commission report, and there's a whole
the bunch of holes in that.
Yeah. So the rest of the world, what you're seeing there in Helsinki and what the rest of the world is seeing is sounds like kind of the meltdown of the Iraqi study group.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's being covered over here. I mean, they're just reporting on what's happening, but believe you me, I mean, everybody is just like, you know, this thing is a disaster, and just to prolong it is going to make it worse.
Yeah, well said. Elaine, thank you very much for the call. Good to hear
Welcome.
From you. Thanks for listening on our, presumably on the web stream there in Helsinki. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Don't worry, wealthy gentlemen, let nothing make us twitch. This new global economy's designed to keep us rich.
We fly our trading Babylons, let all the
And welcome back. Oh, it's indeed 34 minutes past the hour. The Capitol steps again. It's political correctness, you know, and to what extent, how far is it going to go? You have Catherine Albrecht with her book, you know, Help Mom, the Ninth Circuit Court is Stealing Christmas or whatever it is, on the one hand saying, oh, there's a war against Christmas. And then you have folks like me out here who say, I'm a Christian, and I don't think that my religion should be forced on kids in school, and I don't think that it's, and I think it's political correctness to the absurd extreme to say that a school can't acknowledge my or any other religion's holiday, the fact that it's happening, and that there is a line. There's a line there somewhere that state-funded institutions should not cross, where you go from acknowledging a holiday to promoting a particular religious point of view or a particular religious story. It's pretty straightforward. And frankly, the absurdity of it all, in my opinion, is the political correctness of it all. And that's oddly what the left is being attacked for, is for being politically correct. How dare you be politically correct? Be careful. You know, you say happy holidays so as not to offend anybody. And then you say, well, Merry Christmas. Well, somebody gets offended, but it's where does political correctness begin and end? How crazy are we all going to get with this? Are we all going to let Bill O'Reilly make us crazy, or can we laugh at the situation and occasionally at ourselves? John in Ferndale, Washington. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. First-time caller. Yeah, I wanted to tie the supposed war on Christmas, and of course, when Easter comes around, it'll be the war on Easter. Mm-hmm. It's like a frame, you know, the Reconstructionist Christians, they also want evolution to not be taught in schools, right?
Yes, so we had that discussion yesterday, in fact.
Right, and it's like this whole foot-in-the-door thing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with celebrating Christmas or Kwanzaa or whatever, you know, but it's like...
I think this goes way beyond a foot-in-the-door, John. I mean, you know, religion has been in schools forever, and I think it should be. I think that we should be teaching comparative religion in our schools. I think that it's important that people understand the history and roots and teachings of Christianity and Judaism and Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam, the world's major religions. I think that, and frankly, the nature of religions as well. I think that that's important. I think that that's a good thing. I am in favor of churches having tax-exempt status because I believe that spirituality is such an important part of our lives that we as a society should subsidize it. I mean, that's how far I'm willing to go. I'm absolutely right there. But when it comes to kids coming to school, you know, Jewish kids having to participate in a Christmas pageant, or for that matter, Christian kids having to participate in a Wiccan Yule burning ceremony.
You know,
and at that point, I draw the line and say, no, wait a minute. Our schools should not be teaching, should not be preaching religion. They can teach about religion, but that's different from being proponents of a particular religion, whether it's in the science class or whether it's at the holidays.
My whole point is that I think Christians are trying to paint themselves, like you said, as victims when it comes to...
Well, not all Christians.
Not all Christians.
I'm not.
No, me neither. I mean, I'm a Christian who believes in evolution, and I find myself in the minority. But the fundamentalist Christians,
no, actually,
they want
to you're in the
themselves.
Majority. You're in the majority. And last week we interviewed, maybe it was on my local show. I've got a book here from a Christian and a scientist saying that the Bible actually teaches evolution, and he's got all these examples of how the Bible is teaching evolution and how things evolve. For example, Jacob was breeding goats, and he had you know, speckled goats and non-speckled goats, and they bred them in a particular way to end up with more speckled goats. That's evolution. I mean, you know, it's the process of changing species over time. It's
Thanks.
Right there in the Bible.
Great show, Tom. Great
yeah,
show.
Anyhow, thanks a lot, John. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Beverly in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Beverly.
Oh, hi. My favorite talk show host. I wish we had more of that in Pittsburgh.
Well, thank you. You've got some real good talent, though, there with Lynn Cohen.
Oh, yeah. Lynn Cohen's marvelous.
She's wonderful.
Listen, I grew up in New York City, although I live in Pittsburgh now. We had a phenomenon all year round called released time for religious instruction. And they would send out the various Christian kids to various churches, and the Jewish kids, they didn't know what to do with, so they had us learn the Yiddish language, which is ridiculous.
And Yiddish is, you know, mostly German, a little bit of Polish, and a little bit of Hebrew.
Yeah, it's a
Yiddish
wonderful
was...
language, but that wasn't really... And anyway, yeah. That was for religious purposes. We also had lots and lots of Christian songs and Christmas songs, which I loved, and I still do, yeah. Even though I'm not Christian. Yeah. I'm a Unitarian now, believe it or not, because I like ecumenism.
Yeah.
But Hanukkah, they'd play lip service to. They'd have one childish song we devoted to Hanukkah.
Yeah, to what, the
so
dreidel?
Killed up, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what they used to do in the schools. And I hope to God that your point of view, which I agree with 1,000% prevails.
Thank you, Beverly.
You're
welcome. And thank you for the call and for a note of sanity. Gene in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Gene.
Oh, hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about this frame about Christmas, too. I don't think it's a war on Christmas. It sounds more like a war on religious freedom to me.
You're absolutely right, Jean.
And when a theocracy says only one religion will do, that's what's going on.
Yeah, and that's the subtext to the whole, you know, Bill O'Reilly, Catherine DeBrecht, you know, et cetera. The whole thing is, you know, how dare you not allow us to have theocracy? It's about power. It's not about spirituality.
It's about limitation. It's about limiting us to one choice.
Yeah,
you know, instead
yeah.
of all those, a freedom of choice from anything.
Yeah, it's a war on
creating our own religion.
That's a very good way of saying it. It's a war on freedom of religion rather than a war on religion. Yeah, well said. Thank you very much, Gene.
Okay, bye-bye.
Appreciate your comments. Donovan in Eugene, Oregon, KOPT. Hey, Donovan.
Hello. My favorite show.
Thank you.
So, born and raised in San Francisco in St. Stephen's Parish, and... But I was raised on Greek myths, so I loved being a lectern and an altar boy and all the ritual and everything, but it was basic. It's, for me, it was all ethicism. I was being taught is what I always felt, and a lot of old legends and lore and neat rituals. Mm-hmm. So at one point, Bernie Ward from KGO brings up the history of why the Catholic school system even got started. And being raised in Catholic schools, we're relatively hostile. The old schoolers, especially, were relatively hostile toward Protestants, and we kind of felt that they there was just a lot of mean things said about them, as if they weren't terribly smart or well-educated people.
And on the other side, you have Protestants to this day, like Pat Robertson, saying that Catholics can't go to heaven. I mean, you know,
it's on both sides. Yeah, there was a lot of those pre-Vatican II folks who they were just relatively hostile. And at some point, Bernie Ward brings up, he said, the reason why we can't have religion in the schools is when we did, it didn't work between the Christians. That I believe it was in Boston or New York, and I'm sure you probably know, there was, I think it was around 1847 or 1849, the Irish revolted violently because their children were being forced to use the King James Version of the Bible. And
it was actually the second generation of Irish. It was in the 1870s in the Boston schools, and this is what led Horace Mann into this whole thing. Horace Mann was peddling and got finally passed in the late 1870s, early 1880s, as I recall. There's actually an entire chapter about this in my book, Tom Hartman's Complete Guide to ADHD, because it's about the history of the public school system as well. That the Boston had historically been a Protestant city. It was founded originally by the Puritans, who were Protestants. And after 1849, after the first wave of Irish Catholics coming in huge numbers because of the potato famine of 1848-1849 in Ireland, the first generation of Catholics to come into Boston were basically slaves. They were like indentured servants. They were treated miserably, and they were a despised and oppressed underclass. But by the second generation, by the 1870s and 1880s, the children of those immigrants thought of themselves as Americans, and they were sick and tired of being oppressed, and they were starting to demand rights. And they were so numerous that they outnumbered the Protestants in Boston itself, except for the political establishment was still Protestant. And in fact, it was run by, there was this secret society, a Protestant secret society called the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner. And they had a secret handshake and a secret saying. And the secret saying was, I know nothing. So you do the secret handshake and you say, I know nothing. And that's right. That's why the Massachusetts legislature of the 1870s is referred to as the Know-Nothing Legislature. And they were faced with this terrible problem, what to do about the rising power of the Catholics. And Horace Mann came in and said, here's what you do. You do compulsory public education. You force the Catholics to go to state schools and don't allow them to study Catholicism, and you break the bond between the children and the parents, and you're going to break up the communities, and it will diminish the power, this monolithic growing power of the Catholic communities. And there were actually communities where the police came in and had to escort children to school by force of violence, but, you know, with guns. And there's stories that perhaps are apocryphal, but, you know, I've read them. John Taylor Gatto documents this. He's the best source for this, the homeschool advocate. He was the Massachusetts Teacher of the Year 2 years in a row, and he's written several books on this topic about parents who were actually shot by the police because they refused to send their kids to the public school. That was Horace Mann's whole thing. And Horace Mann sold this as a way of helping industry, that we would produce good robots for industry.
And that Americans need to understand there are groups right now that will not allow their children to be taught in a public school religion because it defies Mormonism, it defies, you know, their ecumenical views, all that.
And I think that they have something to say. Thanks, Donovan. 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We got a president so bad, gotta be the worst we ever had. Got the job because of his dad. Now we're all in danger.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com on the line with us. Our senior 79 recommendations correspondent, Victoria.
That is absolutely right. That's how many there are in the Iraq Study Group report.
Is this one of those kind of things where they throw everything out so that no matter what gets done, they can say, see, we told you so?
Well, you could cynically say that. I actually have to say that I think that they put a considerable amount of thought into this and tried to come up with suggestions that made sense and that they think will work, and that they left out things that they think won't work. So, yeah, I have to disagree with you with the premise of your question. I don't think it's a laundry. Unlike Rumsfeld's memo, I don't think it's a laundry list.
Yeah, so you're not as cynical as I am about this.
No, I'm not. I always have hope.
Well, and I honor and respect that. That's a marvelous quality that you have. And frankly, I think I always have hope, too. But I just sometimes am a little more cynical than you are, I guess. But tell us, you know, give us a snapshot of this. You've had, you know, time to digest this, and you're certainly right there in the belly of the beast, in the middle of the milieu in which this is all happening. What is the Iraq Study Group actually, you know, when you get right down to the bottom of it, what are they recommending?
Well, the very first paragraph of the executive summary says the situation in Iraq is grave and deteriorating. There is no path that can guarantee success, but the prospects can be improved. So they set the bar pretty low right there.
Yeah.
Well, among the recommendations,
again, feature very prominently the launching of the diplomatic effort to engage the neighbors and others with an interest in Iraq's stability. Constructive engagement with Iran and Syria, they're mentioned specifically.
Which George W. Bush has ruled out totally. He will not talk to people he doesn't like.
Exactly, exactly. Again, the commitment to the comprehensive Arab-Israeli peace, something that Tony Blair mentioned also today in Prime Minister's Question Time, by the way. He was asked whether we're winning the war in Iraq, and he said, no, we're not. He agreed with Robert Gates from yesterday.
Although Gates ended up qualifying that when the Republicans pressed him. He said, well, we're not losing either.
Right, he did. But he had said twice that we were not winning. So I think two not wins versus one not losing means that we're not winning wins.
I see. Okay.
That's the way I read that one. There are a lot of, but again, no open-ended commitment. Very clear in that. But they also, you know, want to make it very clear to the Iraqi government that the U.S. is going to do what it wants, even if the Iraqi government doesn't live up to its end of the bargain. And it's also very clear in terms of that, you know, we'll reduce our support if you're not making good progress. So in other words, we'll punish them if they don't do what they're supposed to do. That again is something that the president doesn't support.
Yeah. Now, you have, as you mentioned, there are Iraqi politicians. There's some blowback to this being reported. The Associated Press and I suppose other news agencies as well, quoting some Iraqi politicians as saying, this isn't fair. They can't do this to us. I mean, this parliamentarian Mahmoud Othman occurred. He says, the U.S. calls itself an occupying force in Iraq, and according to the Geneva Conventions, if you are an occupier, then you are responsible for the country. They have no right to do this. This is unfair that we would leave. The Kurds are starting to feel abandoned.
Oh, get over it.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the Kurds, every time, you know, we abandoned the Kurds after World War One, we split up Kurdistan. And what happened? The Turks started murdering the Kurds. Saddam started murdering the Kurds. The Kurds have always been the underdogs.
They have. Well, you'd think they'd be used to it by then. I mean,
I think that they deserve some protection.
I think they do, too.
Where the Balkanization of Iraq would be a good idea? You know, breaking it up like Yugoslavia was broken up?
Well, and this is, it's interesting. The Senate Democrats at the press conference this morning, Senators Reid, Levin, and Biden both spoke about this and talked about how this was different from the direction that the president was taking. And Biden didn't really talk about his splitting up of the country idea. Although this is something clearly that the Iraq study group considered, but obviously did not come up with. And it's interesting to me that it is not one of its recommendations.
Indeed.
It is a very real possibility for minorities in that country.
Yeah. Steve in Atlanta has a question for you, Victoria. Steve, you're live with Victoria Jones.
Hey, thanks for getting me on. Victoria, I've just been asking this question all the time is, how come you hear the president all the time say, we ain't leaving until the job's done, or we're not leaving until the mission's over. Well, when are we going to hear a reporter say, you know, Mr. President, what is that mission?
Well, we've asked that, and we've been told it's when the Iraqis can sustain, defend, and govern themselves.
Sort of like what Saddam had.
Kind of, except without one big strong man, with a whole bunch of weak strong men.
Okay, I just never heard that asked explicitly. Thank you.
Yeah,
that is the actual line. That is what we're told.
So, and does the report speak to that? The Iraq study report?
Not what I've seen. I've only seen the executive summary, so I haven't seen it actually speaking to that.
And no. I understand it also does not speak at all to how we got into Iraq in the first place.
No, they weren't asked to do that.
No mention.
But But the Democrats are making it extremely clear, and did so again, if not today, then yesterday, I think, that they fully intend to be holding an awful lot of hearings on that.
And find out, yeah. This goes back to Pat Leahy's statement that Bush should not be afraid about the Democrats coming into office. He should be terrified. Yeah, well, we'll see how it all shakes out. Okay. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, the website. Victoria, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And always great to hear your reports and find out what's going on there in Washington. 56 minutes past the hour. Coming up in our next hour, Orson Scott Card, the science fiction writer. He has a new book out, Empire, a frightening look at an America torn apart by extremism and hate. What happens if we keep going down the road that some suggest we may well be going down? And Larry Scott with VAWatchdog.org will be here.
plus the news, plus your calls. We'll be back with all that and more right after the news at the top of the hour. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
So is it possible that the politics of extremism, that political debate that becomes political diatribe, the politics of fear on both left and right, could lead America to a new civil war? Orson Scott Card, who has a New York Times best-selling author, international best-selling author, Ender's Game, and a whole bunch of other books, many of which have to do with American and world history, has a new novel out, a work of fiction called Empire. And Orson Scott Card, welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Your website, ornery.org?
Uh-huh.
O-R-N-E-R-Y?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
The Ornery American.
There you go, the Ornery American. In the summary of your book, you invoke Oliver Cromwell and suggest, and I think probably most Americans these days, unfortunately, don't even remember who Cromwell was. Well, they couldn't remember.
Most Englishmen don't really.
Yeah, but that was the, what, 6 or 7 years that England experimented with a Protestant church essentially running the state?
Absolutely. It was a horrible experience for them. They had the same experience, basically, in their way that Afghanistan had with the Taliban.
Yeah, and it was so bad that they said...
People laying down their law and rigidly enforcing rules. You know, they banned Christmas. Come on, you can't ban Christmas in England and hope to stay in power.
Right, well, but these were the Puritans. These are the people,
right,
who then came to the United States and founded, you know, Massachusetts.
Right, with similar good effect.
And they banned Christmas here, too, and they started burning witches here and other things. But the point is that the people of England said, enough of this already. We want our kings back. In your book starts out with I don't believe I'm giving away the book here. Stop me at any point if you want. You start out the novel, Empire, we're talking with Orson Scott Card, with the West Wing of the White House being blown up and the vice president being killed in what obviously was not an accidental car accident. And the assumption is some foreign terrorists have gotten us. But then, New York falls and it's obvious that America is under attack from within.
Right. And the idea is that, you know, as I was examining the problem of how would I show a plausible scenario for America being caught up in a civil war, you really don't have a civil war until you have two opposing governments, each claiming legitimacy. And so I had to find a circumstance that I thought would work. It'd be easy to do it from the right because we have how many stories that where people have had right-wingers try to take over the country. So I wanted to go the other direction. See if we had somebody on the left crazy enough to do it, what would they do? What would their strategy be? And went in that direction. The point of the book, though, is not to take sides between blue state, red state. The point of the book is to show that when we allow rhetoric to take us to the extremes that lead to the fear and hatred that provoke civil war, people with any brains at all will be working very hard to try to stop the war, to try to put down anybody who's trying to provoke that kind of situation. Because once the civil war starts, once people start shooting, as they found out in Yugoslavia, as they found out in Rwanda, it doesn't matter how moderate you are, it doesn't matter how much you didn't want to have the war. If the bullet's flying at you because you are perceived as belonging to a certain group, then whether you like belonging to that group or not, you're either going to have to duck, run, or shoot back.
Right, as we found here in the 1860s, and also as we found in the 1770s, frankly, if you read Jimmy Carter's novel, the great novel about the American Civil War, or the American Revolutionary War, and a lot of other work on that time period, at least a third of the War of Independence was a civil war as well. You had families
and it was the
fighting.
Ugliest part. The atrocities were being done by Americans on Americans.
That's right, and that's the part that we don't teach in our public schools, but it was very much there. I'm curious
curious, Orson Scott Card, if in doing the research for your new novel, Empire, you read the Turner Diaries.
No, I did not.
Do you know the story of the Turner Diaries and Tim McVeigh?
No.
Let me just lay this out to you in about a minute and a half, because I'd love to get your take on it and see, you know, what the parallels are. The Turner Diaries is a white supremacist novel that was written by a physicist and written under a pseudonym. And in this novel, a white Protestant lover of America, super patriot, who believes that the government has become oppressive and taken over by liberals, blows up the federal building in Oklahoma City. And the government responds to this by coming down with a heavy fist, repealing the First Amendment rights of free speech, repealing Fourth Amendment rights of privacy, wiretapping people, opening people's mail, doing sneak and peeks in their homes, repealing habeas corpus.
And this was written when?
This was written about 25 years ago. repealing posse comitatus and going house to house to take people's guns. In response to that, the white Protestants, who were so offended by this, rose up with their guns and systematically started killing all the agents of the government, and then started killing all the African Americans, and then started killing all the Jews, and then the Catholics. And in the end of the novel, the only people left standing are the white Protestants who had the foresight to arm themselves and who stood up. Tim McVeigh read that novel, and that's why he blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City. He thought he was going to...
Sounds like he thought he had a script.
He thought he was going to start the American Revolution. He truly believed this. Gore Vidal writes about this in his story, in the book that he wrote about Tim McVeigh. I'm curious if you know, given that story that I just shared with you, are there parallels to that in the novel that you wrote? And do you think that kind of, I mean, I'm telling you right now, there are tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of Americans right now who are devotees of the Turner Diaries, who are stocking weapons and, you know, survivalists and food, and they're getting ready for the day when that happens.
I lived long enough out in the West to know a lot of those people, and they scare me. They scare me very much because, you know, it's one of those situations where, it's the people storing up guns who are probably the people that I would least want to have in power. In other words, I don't want them to save America. I want to be saved from them.
Yeah.
But that's true on every side. I mean, as soon as people start thinking that they are so right that they have the right to kill other people who stand in their way, you have fanaticism, and it poses a danger to everybody. Mm. And so we are right to be vigilant against groups like that. All the time.
Yeah, this is a classic case of the ends justifies the means thinking. I mean, here.
But the thing that scares me, of course, is you know you're talking about a novel that became somebody's script.
Yeah.
Fortunately, the things that I show in Empire are actually not duplicatable without huge amounts of money, and the crazy people are usually not that rich.
Well, so. and not only that, your novel has a more positive ending than Tim McVeigh's, I guess.
Absolutely. Well, the good guys, meaning the people who hate the idea of a civil war, win. Unfortunately, some people start reading Empire and see that I have military people who, you know, we have an all-volunteer military that is overwhelmingly of red state values. And so I have my initial characters, red state people. So they think I'm doing a pro-red state story and they're attacking it accordingly. If they'd finished the book, they'd realize what I'm actually doing is an anti-fanaticism book, but there you go.
Well, you have a long history of being attacked by both the right and the left. I mean,
I figure
at conferences,
as long as
people have
totally pissed off at me. I'm really okay.
Yeah, there you go. I know the feeling. I know the feeling really well. We're talking with Orson Scott Card. Ornery.org is website. He has a new novel out, New York Times bestselling author, a new novel called Empire, a disturbing look at a possible future. To what extent, I mean, just very seriously and soberly here for a moment, to what extent do you think it's possible that the Tim McVeigh kind of scenario or your kind of scenario might actually be played out in America, or a third possibility that another kind of 9/11 coming from an external source could cause our government to be so reactive that it's no longer recognizable as the United, as America with American values?
Well, in one sense, you know, America keeps changing so radically that it already isn't recognizable to people 60 years ago as being the same America.
I'd say
that happens all the time. But, you know, it depends on whether we like the result. And frankly, I don't think that wartime produces very healthy results. No matter what the cause and no matter how just and righteous our cause, it's always a perilous time. And our rights are always put at risk and in jeopardy, because the sad fact of life is it's very hard to win a war. and maintain the full panoply of civil rights and human rights during that time. We're engaged in a fight to the death, as Abraham Lincoln said. I mean, when you're engaged in a fight to the death, as Lincoln said, the Constitution isn't a suicide pact, and you find in every war we've fought some compromises that, fortunately, our history is unique this way, have always gone away at the end.
We've always stepped back.
But if you have a war that never ends, then does it ever go away?
Well, and Bush has declared a war that he says will never end.
Well, it's we're fighting against a very different kind of enemy. I'm not talking about Iraq. I'm talking about the war against Islamic terrorism.
Right, that's what Bush is talking about too.
Yeah, and we don't know where the end of this is. What is obvious to students of history is there is only one very narrow path that leads to any possibility of victory, and about 50 or 60 different scenarios that lead to ruinous defeat. And, you know, we think, you know, what, is Iran going to invade the U.S.? They don't have to. They just have to break apart the trade system that makes the world prosperous, and we'll crash down of our own accord.
Yeah, well said. Orson Scott Card, thought-provoking new novel, Empire, a disturbing look at a possible future, the website ornery.org. Orson Scott Card, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartmann Program.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
He took all the cheese and put them in a tree museum. And he charged the people a dollar and a half to see them. No, 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 don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone. It'd be a paradise and put up a fucking line.
Yes. And it goes on, the paving of paradise and the putting up of the parking lot. Larry Scott with us from VAWatchdog.org, founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org, keeping track of the Veterans Administration because somebody has to. Welcome, Larry.
Hi, Tom. How you doing? And I think you'll probably hear a click or a beep here because I realized I forgot to turn off my call waiting, so let's not let that disturb us.
Okay, that's okay. Fine. A good heads up on the front end. I appreciate that. A new investigation by National Public Radio looked at troops diagnosed with mental health disorders and concluded that, quote, officers at Fort Carson punish soldiers who need help and even kick them out of the Army, end quote,
yes.
According to Paul Rykoff, head of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America.
Yeah, Paul's exactly right, and the NPR program is absolutely excellent. I would encourage all of your listeners to go to NPR.org, and then under All Things Considered, you will be able to find the program. It's fantastic listening and a very, very well-done piece by NPR.
Yeah, you may just put a link to it off VAWatchdog.org and save them a lot of trouble.
Yeah, there is a link, but I think I've got it buried. I should put it up on the front page, actually, so they can find it easily. The report basically is things that we have talked about before. In the armies, in not only the Army, but the other services, in their push to get a handle on the mental health issues that are happening with troops who have been in Iraq and Afghanistan, they're striking out in a way, and they're actually hurting the troops. They're telling the troops, okay, you have an emotional problem, go over here, see this counselor. Oh, you've still got a problem, you're out of here. A lot of times they're given, and we've talked about this before, antidepressants and sent back overseas, back into a combat role. A number of times now we're finding they're actually removed from the service. And this is something that we saw during Vietnam that was very, very frightening. People who were having mental health issues were removed from the service and given a code called a PD, a personality disorder. Say, well, this guy, he's fighting, he's angry, he's not sleeping well. Maybe he's drinking too much. Well, it's obviously a personality disorder. We're finding this whole thing coming back around again, Tom. The problem with a personality disorder is, one, the VA considers it non-treatable, and right, it is non-compensable. You see where we're going here?
Sure. Where we're going is basically people join the military. They get psychologically wounded by combat and by the experiences that they have. That psychological wound is relabeled by the military as being something that they were born with.
Brought with them.
Yeah, or brought with them into the military, and they wash their hands of them.
Right, they wash their hands completely. And it, at the other end of the line, then, you now have a veteran, someone who is out of the service. He's been labeled with having a personality disorder or mental health issues of that nature that the VA considers non-treatable and non-compensable, and they're out there high and dry on the street. We're seeing this more and more today, the personality disorder issue coming up. They're being abandoned by the government that has used them in the military. This is completely uncalled for, and this is something that veterans groups are really on top of. They're trying to watch this entire issue. And you mentioned Paul Rykoff of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Paul is the one who's been blowing the whistle on this for some time now, and rightly so, because what we are doing is we're taking people, putting them into battle, putting them under that stress, and then abandoning them when they need our help the most.
Yeah. Now, the over at VAWatchdog.org, you're talking about the Veterans Administration budget. And there, I've spoken with a couple of people. Actually, I forget if it was Eleanor Victoria, one of our correspondents at Talk Radio News, had lunch with a senior elected Republican. I didn't get whether it was a member of the House or a member of the Senate, but a longtime Republican who was a friend of hers. She wasn't going to out him by naming him. And he said that the Republican caucus had gotten together in secret and decided that they were going to do everything they could to drop as many disasters as possible into the laps of the Democrats on January 4th or 7th or whenever Congress begins, so that the Democrats would be so distracted just trying to deal with disasters that they wouldn't have time to launch investigations into the Republicans. And that if any of those disasters blew up in anybody's face, the Democrats would take the blame rather than the Republicans. It looks like that's happening with the VA budget.
Right. There are 9 spending bills right now that are hung up, that just looks like there is no chance they're going to get out of Congress. They're going to go to another continuing resolution until it looks like sometime in February. What that means is these agencies, including the VA, will be stuck operating at last year's funding level. They won't have the new influx of money they need to operate properly. And this is a gimmick. It is a gimmick by the 109th Congress. It is being done deliberately. And they're even starting to cover themselves now, because what's interesting, I've noticed interplay between House members and Senate members. They say, well, the House is doing this because, and then on the other side, no, the Senate's doing it because. So although they're playing the game, they are at the same time running for cover, so that when this does explode next year, and it will, there will be some kind of cover for those members of the 109th who are continuing into the 110th. Mainly, those happen to be senior Republicans.
Right. So the Republicans really and truly are setting up the Democrats, even with veterans.
And it's a shame. With a number of agencies that need funding now, and they need their increase in funding to operate properly, but especially veterans, they have tried to tag on a little bit of extra money to the continuing resolution. It hasn't happened.
Amazing. Amazing. Yep. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website. Larry, thanks for being with us today.
Tom, thank you so much.
Always good talking with you. We'll be back with the news of the day and your calls right after this, 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 866-440-8466.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where despair is not an option. Get active! Well, Dennis Prager, the right-wing crank who is demanding that Congressman-elect Keith Ellison, the Democrat from Minnesota, the first Muslim elected to Congress, must use a Christian Bible for his photo op of being sworn in, is finding himself... let me rephrase the sentence. The Holocaust Memorial Museum, which has Dennis Prager on its board, is distancing itself from him. They have made an official announcement saying that he speaks solely for himself and does not reflect the position of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. The problem is they can't remove him from their board.
Why? Because he was appointed by George W. Bush. It's a presidential appointment. The president appointed this right-wing crank to the Holocaust Memorial, U.S. Holocaust Memorial Board, Museum Board, and they're stuck with it. The Council on American-Islamic Relations says, Prager's continued presence on the council sends a negative message to Muslims worldwide about America's commitment to religious tolerance. And in the Anti-Defamation League, a group that combats anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry called Prager's Views, Prager, who himself is Jewish, by the way, called Prager's Views, although he takes the right-wing Christian position on his talk show, Prager's Views intolerant, misinformed on the facts, and downright un-American. Amen. As they say. In the meantime, let's take a look here for just a second before we go to the phone calls of what's going on with the U.S., the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq and the civil war happening therein.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance.
Following our security and other developments in Iraq as of 10:30 GMT on Wednesday. Dateline Baghdad. This all from Reuters, by the way. Mortar rounds fell on a busy commercial street in central Baghdad, killing 10 and wounding 54. In Suwayra, mortar rounds landed in an area north of that town, killing one person and wounding two. In Baghdad, a suicide bomber blew himself up inside a minibus in the Shiite Sadr city, killing three people and wounding 16. In Baghdad, a U.S. aircraft killed one terrorist and detained another near the town of Khanikan, east of Baghdad, according to the U.S. military. In Iskandaria, a bomb inside a shop killed its owner and three others and wounded 12. In Kirkuk, police found a body with gunshot wounds. In Hawija, gunmen killed a police officer on his way to work. In Baghdad, gunmen attack a police brigadier, wounding him and killing his driver in a drive-by shooting in the Al-Mansur district. In Mosul, gunmen seriously wounded a university professor. In Khalis, gunmen attacked a minibus carrying farm workers, killing one and wounding eight. In Mosul, police found the headless body of an army officer. And this from the Associated Press, 10 U.S. soldiers were killed in Iraq today in two IED attacks. Fighting in Baghdad and an intense battle in Ramadi led to 191 Iraqis killed or found dead and 91 injured. This all being ginned up, let us not forget that it was in August of 2002. A member of the Bush administration was asked, are you going to start promoting a war in Iraq? And he said, no, in the summer, we roll out new products in the fall. And in September, George W. Bush started whipping up the war in Iraq, leading to a vote and a resolution in October to flip the political elections in November of 2002 so that the Republicans could take back control of the Senate. And as Cindy Sheehan testified before John Conyers Commission, this was not just an idea they hatched out of thin air the day before.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, one of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote.
Yes, George W. Bush. But in September, he instead was telling us...
He said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Yeah, and now we know that that's simply not true, that it was a lie. The Iraq Study Group talking about the lie? No. Not at all. Ed in Arlington, Washington. Hey, Ed, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. Your guest in the last segment, your VA guest.
Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, yeah.
Thank you. He answered the question that your screener asked me, and I didn't have an answer for it. I told her that I kind of felt very, very, very uneasy ever since the election. It was too easy. Considering the machinery that the neocons had in place, they could have ripped off every election statewide. They could have walked away with it. In fact, they didn't. And it's almost, to use a sports analogy, it's like they're running a slow-motion screen pass play.
Mm-hmm. Or there's the pool shark analogies, too. You know, you lose the first three games, and then you up the bet.
They don't even bother to play.
Yeah.
I mean, and now she asked me, she says, okay, now when they do exercise the play and they fake us all out and they throw the pass, what's it going to be? And I told her I didn't know. Well, your guest just answered it. We're going to get dumped with all this crap. And I think that if the Democratic leadership is really sharp, they're going to keep the U.S. public informed, a la the old fireplace chats. Mm-hmm. I mean, I want to hear every week or every 2 weeks from Nancy Pelosi or the leadership about what's going on in Congress, who's blocking what, who's refusing to do what. So when they do try and play the blame game, they got nobody to blame but themselves.
Well, we can hope. The problem, Ed, is that this strategy of setting it up, setting the next Congress up, which, you know, implicitly is the Democrats, for failure, is one that Democrats have been loudly complaining about and loudly pointing out for weeks now, for weeks. And it has gotten no play whatsoever. The press just doesn't pick it up. Harry Reid talks about, I've gotten 4 or 5 news releases from Harry Reid's office. I mean, literally, the news releases that they send out to the media, I'm on their list. I get one every day. And I've gotten at least 4 or 5 of them in the last 2 or 3 weeks, which is probably 20 or 30% of the total that he's sent out, talking about this very issue. And I have not seen it on one newscast. I have not heard it be the subject of one radio newscast. I have not seen it on any of the network news. I haven't even heard National Republican Radio talking about it. It is as if there's a media blackout about it. And you know, it's just the Republican bias of the large Republican corporate media in the United States is so powerful and so at work here that I frankly think that the Republicans are going to pull this thing off.
Well, I tell you, if the Democrats can pull the same thing that the Republicans did, if these networks and news agencies won't report the story, they have no access.
Yeah, well, see, that's the problem. I mean, first of all, there's a lot of Democrats because there's not a singular president, right? I mean, with a president, you can say, okay, you don't have access. You've got tremendous power there. With members of Congress, the House, or the Senate, you can simply say, okay, I'm not going to talk to you. They say, fine, I'll find somebody else to talk to. So that's not a power. Secondly, remember when Bill Clinton left office, there was that story about the Clintonites, his, you know, the Clintonistas or whatever they called them, you know, trying to make it sound like they were communists, had taken all the W's off the keyboards.
Yeah, that was a lie.
It was absolutely a lie, and it was debunked the very day it was put out by the right-wing machine, by Drudge and the right-wing talk show hosts. The very day it was put out, it was denied by the General Accounting Office. It was debunked by the federal government itself. And yet, I'll bet you, Ed, today, 80% of Americans still think that happened.
Well, agreed. I mean, 80% of the people still think Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11.
Yeah, I understand. But, I mean, the point is, if the Republican media machine was so effective in trashing Clinton on the way out of office,
Do you really think that they're going to allow the Democrats to trash the Republicans on the way out of office? I just don't think so.
I think if the Republicans get up off their duffs and get some backbone,
you mean the Democrats
demand it?
Yeah. Well, let's hope so. Let's hope so, Ed. And let's all hold our media accountable. And I encourage you to write letters to the editor of your local paper. And I'll keep on the topic. I certainly will. We'll see who else does. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Is there anybody here who'd like to change his clothes into a uniform? Is there anybody here who thinks they're only serving on a raging storm? Is there anybody here with glory in their eyes, loyal to the end, whose duty is to die? I want to see him, I want to wish him luck, I want to shake his hand, want to call his name, put a medal on the man.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just got an amazing fax here from a young man in Eugene, Oregon. I'm not going to give his name on the air, but he says, Tom, this is a real-life story of how bad we need to fund education, with proof included, since some people will not believe it's true. He says, I'm attending Pioneer Pacific College here in Eugene. During my time, I was eligible for student loans because I would attend at least half-time, 6 credits while I worked. For the term, he's an adult. For the term that I am in now, I have no choice but to take only 5 credits. That meant no student loan, and I had to come up with about $950 or stop going to school. Because of poor credit, I went to a title loan company. These are the companies that will loan you money against your car. They loaned me $475 in the title to my car. The catch was that the annual interest rate is 365%. After I picked up my jaw from off the floor, I realized that the bankruptcy bill removed the usury limit that was once the basis for racketeering charges. He says, I'll do my damnedest to pay this off early, but this kind of policy should be once again criminalized. And special interests must be stopped from pulling the strings of our representatives. Are they there to represent the people to begin with, or the credit card companies? I want to give those who voted for that bill a very generous D-. And then he attaches the copy of the installment loan and security agreement from, Northwestern Title Loans in Eugene. The annual percentage rate, 365%. $475 financed. The finance charge is $1,333.40 on a $475 loan. So for 12 months, he's making payments of $150.70 a month. This is wrong. I'm sorry. This is wrong. There's just no other way to describe it. As our society becomes increasingly stratified, as we have more and more people who are in the working poor, And then you have predators coming in and go, oh, we can make some money off the poor. It's always easy to make money off the poor, or off the working poor, off the people who are just struggling to get into the middle class. Amazing. Virginia in Seattle. Hey, Virginia, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. I'm part Indian myself, and both my mom and dad are. And I know that some tribes, I don't know what all their customs are, but they have a ceremony for returning warriors. Mm-hmm. In some cases they build a sweat lodge and an older man goes in with the younger man and they do the ceremony for 3 days and help them readjust to society and cleanse. It's a cleansing ceremony, cleanse them of the horrors of war.
Yes.
And I suggest that the people in your neighborhood that have returning warriors, that you do it yourself, because your government isn't going to do it.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. We have rites of passage, for example, is another thing that you find in all Aboriginal and Indigenous societies, a transition from childhood to adulthood. There are always rites of passage, and there are remnants of that left in our modern society, in Judaism, the Mar Mitzvah and the Bat Mitzvah, the confirmation in Catholicism. even graduation from high school historically has been a rite of passage. But our rites of passage are being stripped from us by and large. Particularly the high school graduation has lost a lot of its meaning, and the returning from war, after World War II there was a huge ritual around returning from war. I mean, there were parades, there were celebrations, and in a way it was not just a celebration of war and of victory, but it was an opportunity to say, okay, that's over, that end of our life is closed, we're closing that door and we're moving forward into back into the civilian world. And with these wars that continue forever, like the Vietnam War and the Iraqi War, and to some extent the Korean War as well, there is no transition point where a veteran can stand up and say, okay, this is the transition point.
And most of them realize that they have innocent blood on their hands. On some level of consciousness, they do, and they need to be absolved of that.
Yes, I agree. Virginia, thank you for sharing that. It's a very insightful comment. I appreciate it. Jude on the line. Hey, Jude.
Hey, Tom. Gosh, it's just an excellent show today.
Thank you.
I wanted to go back to the young woman when you were reading an excerpt from her book, and you were reading about Mrs. Clinton. And
Catherine DeBrecht.
Right. And you said that that's such hatred in there. And she laughed, and she said, no, it's not. I was walking in the store with my daughter, and it was such a cruel statement that, you know, to have written something in a book like that. Mm. And I thought how profoundly unchristian that was. And then I started thinking about the people that are teachers for these individuals. I mean, millions of them. And I pulled up last night, there's a fellow by, his name is Dr. James Kennedy. He's one of the largest televangelists in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And he runs Coral Ridge Presbyterian Church in Florida.
I'm familiar with him.
Well, they're going to have, in March, a two-day seminar. It's called Reclaiming America for Christ. And two of the guest speakers are going to be Phyllis Schlafly.
She was on this program Monday of last week. Yeah.
And also Ann Coulter.
Oh, my.
And,
main proponents of hatred.
Absolutely. But too, it comes back to the thing that there's so many diversions going on. Tonight it's late, but on Air America at 11 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
Marge Cohen from the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego is going to be speaking on martial law and the detention centers that Kellogg, Brown, and Root.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also involved in a case with Gonzalez in Germany. So it's
great.
Late, but if you get a chance, and bless your heart, Tom, for everything.
Thanks for the heads up, Jude, and thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to have a fascinating day, but I lost my paper here. we'll find out. I know we're going to be debating a conservative. I guarantee you that. And remember, my friends, don't ever forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.